Hi, everyone. Welcome back to the Compio Cafe. We're your hosts, Melissa
and Janae.
As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments to share with us, please email them to podcast@blackwomencompio.org or leave us a voicemail at 302-715-2922. That's 302-715-BWCB. We may share your response here on the show. And we'd love to hear your general questions, comments about the comp bio field, and more. But yes, this is a podcast that is brewing up fresh perspectives in the comp bio field. And this is one of the episodes that we're calling our cafe chats, where we don't have an interviewee, but we're talking about a topic related to the field, sharing our perspectives and experiences, and hoping to also incorporate some of your experiences and stories as well. So yeah, we'll start with some latest news. I think as of today, February 17th, when we're recording, something that is making the rounds is this Frontiers article, which has since been retracted, but has two figures that were generated by AI, DALL-E. These figures are incredibly questionable to even the most inexperienced person who knows anything about what a rat looks like. And also, I think the most disturbing thing is not even that these were generated, but that these made it all the way to publication and weren't necessary. Yeah. Like, I don't know if people hadn't seen this, if like how long it would have taken for this to actually be corrected.
Well, when I first saw the image, I thought that it was just like, oh, look what AI done did. And I was like, oh, okay. But learning that it was actually published, I was shocking because it was very glaring that like something's wrong here.
Yeah. Several things are wrong. Like, and I don't know, like, I feel like just as we... I don't know if you also went through this stage of education in which it was shoved down our throats how important it was to check sources, like during library class, know how to like read an actual book as a reference, know how to like, I think we're going to have to start teaching that acumen to people, especially some of the older generations. I don't know if a human looked at this paper, I'm going to be completely honest. But what? Like, because we're seeing that the words on this figure are not words. They're not English words. They're not interpretable.
I didn't even look at the words, to be honest. I was just like so enamored by the image itself. So that's crazy. Well, I'm gonna have to pull this up.
And it's not even just the rat one. They made another one, like a metabolic pathway. Also completely, it was their figure too. Also completely generated by generative AI and also makes an equal amount of no sense.
I am looking at the words now. These, and like the thing is, like, you look at it fast enough, you're like, oh, those are science words, you know, like, it is what it is. But yeah. Oh, I see the metabolic one now. That's so crazy because the amount of time that I've spent on like creating figures like similar to this metabolic one and like looking at so many papers and making sure everything is just right. Disturbing. So what do you think? Yeah, what do you think is going to happen now? Do you think like there's going to be an AI filter, like a step in the paper review process of like, is this AI?
But are they going to get AI to do that? Or are they going to get a human to do that? I don't know. I think there are many things we can say about the way that we value certain publications anyway. So I feel like people are already looking at this as like, see, this is why we don't publish in such and such journals. I don't know. Like, would we say the same if this came out in Cell?
I feel like it would be even more appalling if it came out in Cell.
What is predatory publishing? Do you have a definition for that?
I don't. You tell me.
Okay. I think people generally use the word predatory to describe practices in which a journal might be scouting out or procuring submissions to their journals through practices that might not necessarily be founded on merit, quote unquote, or
it doesn't have
expertise, if that makes
sense. Yeah, it doesn't have any scientific rigor to the...
Right. Okay, that's a better way to put it. We won't use the M word. We'll use lack of scientific rigor. And right, we don't usually see an extensive peer review process included. Now, I saw someone who, I don't know if he's like from BioArchive or frequently reviews stuff, but he's saying like, even before you put something on BioArchive, like a human is looking at that and would have been able to catch this right away, that like, mm-hmm. this does not belong, even in a preprint server. So like, there's a very, very high level review that goes into you being able to put something on one of the archives. Yeah. And the fact that that was completely lacking for this particular journal is
very concerning. Yeah, very concerning, mm-hmm. especially because like images like this are usually what makes it to the general public faster. Like mm-hmm. when they're, you know, shrunk diagrams and things. So if you're not going to be screening for like how, one, is this correct and how will this be perceived, then what's the point?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's crazy.
So there's that. I hope that we can start getting ready as a scientific field for what's to come, because this is only the beginning. All right. So the question of the day is, what are the basic programming languages you think computational biologists should know? Someone asked this question on Twitter a few weeks ago, actually. And this kind of will lead into our main topic, which is keeping up with literature, emerging trends in the comp bio field. But we can start with Melissa. Maybe how do you approach answering this question of where should people start in terms of programming languages?
Yeah, my first instinct is to go with a tool like R or Python, because that those are more like data analytics focused languages that you can, like, especially for beginners, where you can download public data and do a quick analysis or quickly visualize the data. But I think as your needs grow and as you're working with the data from the more of the start of the pipeline, you're definitely going to need to have some skills in like Bash and potentially other things if you're doing more on the tool building side. Like Rust is really popular for bioinformatic tools.
Or like workflow development. So being familiar with like SnakeMake,
Whittle,
CWL, different workflow. I wouldn't say they're languages, more so like structures.
Yeah, what do you call that? NextFlow is also a good one.
Yes, NextFlow is probably more popular than SnakeMake, especially for bioinformatics, because I think they have more bioinformatics like focused resources. And I feel like they were built with just a lot of bioinformatics people in mind.
Mm-hmm. I think they're just called...
It's a standard.
Yeah, standard workflow language.
Yeah. Melissa, you ended up saying Bash?
Yeah, Bash, like for using tools to work with sequencing data, aligning and trimming and extracting reads or whatnot.
Yeah, I guess I also just put that in the category of like when you get to a point where you need to do repetitive tasks over and over, you'll need to know how to generate or create a Bash script in the Linux or Unix environment to kind of build your own kind of workflows or like pipelines or just, you know, stringing together different scripts that you need. I think right. I didn't take like a formal class in this, though. I just kind of had to learn as I went. If you're a comp sci major, I think like you take a class in like Linux and Unix, but you learn more so about the background and infrastructure as opposed to like, you're not, I don't think the focus was like being evaluated off of like any level of proficiency. But I think the most important that Melissa said is R, Python, and any other thing that you'll need outside of that. I kind of come from the perspective of have a data set in mind, whether you're a computational person or if you're an experimental person and you're used to generating certain types of data, take that data and just take it a step further. Think more critically about how you're going to generate insight on that. That's more so the bioinformatics of it. And there are a lot of resources out there. But if you're finding, like, for instance, you are needing to create a new tool or string together different tools to get an answer for something, then you'll need a little bit more of the workflow and like pipeline development tools, maybe some more Python knowledge to kind of help with that.
All right. So how do you keep up with the literature or emerging trends in the field?
Social media.
Yeah.
I realize people like lately have been following me on GitHub, but I don't really like use GitHub that way. Mm-hmm. But I think for people who want to be like on the ground of like their favorite labs or like groups developments on a tool, maybe I think, I don't, is that what people use it for? I don't know. I don't have much on mine. So
the only thing I can think about bioinformatics side on GitHub is like the Tidyomics movement. They're very heavily on GitHub and they have open projects and challenges and things like that that you can go in and develop tools for.
So yeah, using LinkedIn more so for person-specific or company-wide updates on like what a company is doing or movement in the kind of like business space.
Yeah, I've been seeing people post their papers more on LinkedIn too, and so personal advances in the field.
Yeah, and I think sometimes I do follow like the BioArchive bioinformatics page on Twitter. I used to get alerts for it, but I was realizing I will always get alerts all the time, all day. So
yeah,
I like that BioArchive has different sections. Archive, I think, also still has a quantitative biology section if you're interested. But yeah, the preprint servers are a great way to see literally what's emerging and what people are thinking about.
Are you on Twitter still for science Twitter, or have you moved to a different social media platform?
Yeah, I'm still there. Unfortunately, I'm still there. I think, well, I don't know. After this rat figure, I feel like it woke some people up on science Twitter. I thought there was going to be a huge exodus, but my following is very focused on science. So yeah, and I think Blue Sky is going to become the next Twitter-like space for conversational science. I'm still having a hard time navigating seeing content I actually want to see on there. But it's because I don't have a large following.
Same. I think when I first transitioned over to Blue Sky, I was like, dang, I really had a lot of like, especially a lot of Black scientists that I followed on Twitter. I'm like, ugh, I'm going to miss seeing that. So
yeah,
I think it'll get there, but it'll just take some time and finessing. Maybe like there's going to be another tool that goes on top of Blue Sky to help customize what the feed looks like better.
Yeah, or yeah, I could be missing something, but I think there's value there. I see people are joining it. I need to build up my experience. Here's another question. Are conferences helpful in keeping updated, or is that old school?
I think they are helpful, specifically with like personal connections too. The last big conference that I went to was ASHG, and the talks I felt like were really helpful in figuring out like, oh, what's everyone doing? You know, like, what's the standards of analyses nowadays? What's the standards of what kind of data people are collecting and using to answer those questions? So I find the talks really helpful in that way. And then I really like connecting with people that I've followed on Twitter in real life and been like, oh, you're a real person. That's great.
Yeah, I am lucky to be able to go to a few a year. And I think like it's the best way to put the faces to the scientific names, or, you know, discover new faces and names. That in-person component is really important. So I think being able to interact with the science that way is never going to be too old school for me. Yeah, because I think the conferences really rely on the community aspect of science in kind of fostering.
I love the dialogue that comes out of like after certain talks, like, you know, people are just like sharing ideas. Like when I went with my colleagues from work, it was like after a talk, we're like huddle up, like, oh, like, what do you think about this? Do we, you know, should we do this? Should we, you know, try and collaborate with them? Like things like that. It creates a lot more buzz when you're like in person and able to just like get that direct feedback.
And that's true for small conferences. Like I've been to a conference with 150 people and, you know, the bigger ones like ASHG, obviously different dynamics because ASHG probably has more, you know, social stuff surrounding it. But this last conference I went to, actually the FASB RNA processing in cancer one, it was super small, but they also intentionally built in time for people to go like sightseeing and like museums and do activities for a whole day within the conference program. That just added a completely new layer of experiencing science and networking for me that I feel like you can't always really get at the big ones.
That makes me remember, there used to be, and there might be, I just don't know. There used to be a bioinformatics conference that was in Hawaii every year. And then PSB? There's also, is that what it is?
I think so.
And then there was also some conference that's always at a ski resort. Those two.
The Rockies? Rocky Mountain? Mm-hmm. Yeah. I know Sanj is at one in Punta Cana, Cancun.
Oh.
It's an RNA conference, a fusion conference.
I need to like more strategically figure out how I can get myself there.
Yeah. All right. So where can we find the CompBio community at?
I feel like we're really spread out. I feel like we're in our niches, but I think still Twitter, potentially Blue Sky, and at conferences.
Yeah. LinkedIn, I think it's easy to search by like keywords from people's like headlines. So if you're looking for specific people or for professionals, there's that. Still social media. I think I'm also seeing like more CompBio content on platforms like YouTube. Like I know at least two now creators, quote unquote, who like do educational content and resources on bioinformatics specifically on YouTube. So I feel like when I started, like maybe in college, I wasn't really able to see stuff like that. So there could be a good community that's built around resources like that as well.
Yeah, I have a whole like not YouTube account, but like one of my Gmails associated with my YouTube is literally just bioinformatics channels. Because in my head, like if I go on YouTube and I see like a science video, I'm going to watch it and like learn something. Do you have anybody that you're thinking of off the top of your head?
Absolutely not.
Okay. The person I'm thinking of is at the Lieber Institute for Brain something. His name is Leonardo. And he has like a Rstats, what do you call those things? Journal clubs that I think he hosts in person, like as a part of running his lab there. But he also puts the videos on YouTube. And I think he has like, sometimes he has virtual things.
Yeah, I would need to go looking, but maybe we can put in some of those resources on our page. Yeah. Another place to find community is BWCB. If you happen to be a Black woman in the field anywhere in the world, learn more about us at blackwomencombio.org. So that's all we have for today. If you have any more questions or comments or things that you want to contribute to this question of getting into the field, staying up with the field of comp bio, we'd love to hear your thoughts via email at podcast@blackwomencombio.org. Or leave us a voicemail at 302-715-2922. And with that, I'm Janae.
And I'm Melissa.
See you guys in the next episode. The Comp Bio Cafe podcast is brought to you by Ijama Miramiku, Melissa Minto, and Janae Adams. Learn more about us at blackwomencompbio.org and also tap into ways that you can become a member or a supporter today. Thank you for listening.